Introduction to the 2003 Summer Institute was presented by Jack Crabtree on August 10, 2003 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Postmodernism, Reason, and the Church. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Okay, I think mostly what I would like to do by way of orientation is go over this chart that I've handed out. I got a phone call after attempting to read some of your reading saying, "Yow, this is way over my head." Let me comment on that. Some of you have probably already figured this out in your lives, but others of you may still at some level be struggling with this. It's very easy to read the kind of reading that we assigned you today and feel stupid. That's just a natural, normal, ordinary reaction. You should feel stupid, and I'll explain why you should feel stupid. There's a number of reasons. First of all, whenever you're reading a philosopher, you are eavesdropping on a conversation that philosopher is having with other people. It's just a given. And when you're not aware of what they're responding to and who they're responding to and what that person that they're responding to has said, you're very much an outsider of that conversation. And so you have the added task of not only understanding what this philosopher is saying, but reconstructing what it must be that he's responding to. And that's all a part of the task of exegeting a philosopher, of interpreting a philosopher. And that's difficult. I mean, any way you cut it, that's difficult. Even if the philosopher does his best to make it easy for you, that's still difficult. Second thing that's related to that is, philosophy, like any other discipline, has its own jargon. It's a different language. It's not English. It's philosophy spoken in something that resembles English. And if you have not become fluent in the language of philosophy, then it's burdensome to wade through this wondering, what on earth do they mean by that word? I still don't know what Derrida and Foucault mean by half the words that they use. Presence. What is presence? I don't know. I'm still not sure. And the only way that you do know is by spending enough time with it and dialoguing with other people about it and getting more background information, becoming more and more familiar with their ideas until the light goes on and you go, oh, okay, that's what they mean by that word. Well, it takes time, and I know it takes time. And when you're reading this for the first time, no one can honestly expect you to get it the first time through. Third thing is, the thing that took me years and years of reading philosophy to understand is, one of the reasons that I feel stupid when I read these philosophers, like Hume, for example, one of the reasons Hume makes me feel stupid is because they're stupid arguments. And for the life of me, there's this famous, intelligent, bright philosopher writing in what seems like clear enough English, and I go, and he goes, "This, therefore this." And I'm going, "This, therefore this? Why should that make any sense?" And being self-doubting enough, I assume that the problem is with me. Yep, that should follow from that, and I'm just so stupid, I don't get it. I don't know why that follows from that, even though he says it should. Well, as I grew and got older and wiser and more hip and more mature, I realized that doesn't follow from that at all. And I wasted a lot of emotional energy and self-doubt on trying to make sense out of something that I really should have been able to go, "That doesn't make any sense, David. That doesn't follow." Well, you need to develop over the course of time some confidence to be able to do that, and you don't automatically have that confidence, especially when you're confronting all these other realities of reading a foreign language and eavesdropping on a conversation that you're not a first party to. So all that stuff, all combined, mixed together, makes it very, very difficult, and we understand that, and we don't expect you to have read these things as if they're crystal clear. All you can really do is expose yourself to it and begin the dialogue. Now, some of us may appear like we have grasped it a little bit more than you did. There's two reasons for that. One is we're capable of BS and looking good, even when we don't know what we're talking about. That's one. And secondly, I've read it six or seven times by now in my career, and the more you read it, the more you're exposed to it, the more you get each time, the more familiar you become. It just takes a while. So what I am capable of doing the sixth time through, don't feel intimidated if you didn't get that the first time through. There, nevertheless, I think by having exposed yourself to it and jumped in and we begin the dialogue, I think there's much that we can profit from by reading these readings and discussing these readings. So we're going to do that. If you want to look at the back, I've outlined the perspective that I'm going to take in my lectures, and let me explain what I'm doing here in these lectures. I'm going to basically, kind of dogmatically assert my perspective on the Bible and truth and reason and postmodernism and how they all fit together. But I want you to understand the spirit in which I do that. It is never our intention at Gutenberg to impose a way of looking at anything on people. That's for you to work out. And our job as tutors is to be fellow learners and dialogue partners in that process. You don't have to agree with me, and I don't have to agree with you. We're all coming to try to gain our own perspective and find our own way. But for the sake of getting the dialogue started and giving us something to talk about, my purpose in the lectures is going to be to tell you what I think. Here's my perspective, and here's how I put it all together. And I should say, at this point in my life, I am very new to postmodernism. I have not been particularly interested in it until recently. It has always struck me as a bit bizarre and a perspective that is not going to really help me a whole lot in what I am interested in. So I'm relatively new to it. Some of you may know more than I do about postmodernism. What I do bring to the lectures is I do know something about the Bible, and I do know something about the biblical worldview and a biblical perspective. And so I think what I do have to offer in terms of my expertise is to give you some perspective on what a biblical worldview, how it respond to some of these things that postmodernists appear to be saying. Whether they are or not is another question, but responding to what they appear to be saying. So with that in mind, here's the perspective, sort of the bottom line of where my lectures are going on the backside there. I'm going to argue that some of the themes and some of the emphases of postmodernism include some very important and profoundly true insights. Some aspects of what postmodernism is saying are very helpful to us to understand. I think that's true. I will argue, however, that those insights are not original to postmodernism. They're not unique to postmodernism. They've been with us as long as the New Testament has been with us. I mean, the best part of postmodernism was already there in the teaching of the New Testament, I will argue. So I don't think it has anything new to teach us. But to the extent that it has anything to say to us at all, it has, by way of reminder, by way of provoking thought, by way of remembering, gaining insight into what the New Testament is saying, I think there's something valuable there that postmodernism can contribute. There are other themes and other emphases in postmodernism that I think are in direct contradiction to common sense, direct contradiction to the biblical worldview, direct contradiction to moral goodness, and in those respects, therefore, postmodernism is an enemy of biblical faith, and it's a mindset that is intellectually dangerous and spiritually destructive. So some of the emphases of postmodernism, we really need to understand how destructive that they would be. And so putting those two together, therefore, there is nothing to gain and everything to lose by seeking to interpret the Christian faith into the language and categories of postmodernism. What there might be to gain, we don't really need postmodernism to help us with that. We can go to the language of the New Testament itself, and we'll be in the same advantageous position. And in other respects, postmodernism can only destroy and subvert our faith. It really won't aid it. Now, you don't have to agree with those conclusions, but that's just where my lectures are going to go, and you can interact with that, argue with that, make your case against those things, whatever you choose to do. But that's going to be the bottom line of my lectures. I don't know if I'll get an opportunity to do this elsewhere, so let me just define what I mean by common sense here. If you got a chance to read Thomas Reed, Thomas Reed is one of my heroes, a very neglected philosopher until very recently, but in fact, much maligned philosopher until very recently. And he was so maligned in my education process that I stayed away from him. It wasn't until we got into the Gutenberg curriculum and I read him for the Gutenberg curriculum and I went, wow, this guy is amazing. I just think his contribution is truly, truly fundamental from a Christian point of view, from a biblical point of view. But one of the ways in which he's misunderstood is that he's considered a champion of common sense. But it's crucial to know what he means by common sense. When I was an undergraduate, when they taught Thomas Reed to me, they understood Thomas Reed to be a champion of the prejudices, the views, the perspectives, the beliefs of the masses, or what Thomas Reed calls the vulgar. Hope none of you are offended by that. You know, the vulgar is just us, the common, ordinary people. You probably noticed in reading as much as you read from him, that's not what he's saying. He doesn't mean by common sense everything that everybody everywhere believes, no matter how superstitious or prejudiced or outlandish or bizarre it might be. He doesn't trust the common man to be clear-headed all the time. That's not his perspective. He recognizes that philosophy has a very important role to play in calling us to discipline and clarity and defining our terms and all the things that philosophy can rightly contribute. Thomas Reed recognizes that. But Thomas Reed does believe that we have a creator God who created human beings with the equipment, if you will, the noetic mind, intellectual equipment, if you will, to be able to learn, to be able to go out into the world, experience the world, and learn what there is to know about the world. And that equipment does not fail us. That equipment works. And that equipment has certain foundational structures to it, a certain foundational set of principles according to which that equipment operates, so designed by our designer to be able to operate, to actually get us in touch with the world as it is, and reality as it is, to bring us to true knowledge of the world external to us, rather than to deceive us and trick us and mystify us with illusions of one kind or another. My mind works, he thinks. So when he talks about common sense, he doesn't mean a set of beliefs. He means the structures and principles of human intelligence that every human being shares in common. And the reason he calls it common sense is that this is the commonly, universally held equipment, noetic equipment, that every human being has. And it's the principles and structures of that equipment that he understands to be common sense. That's what I mean. So just to be clear, whenever I use the word common sense, that as well is what I'm going to mean by the word common sense. Okay, if you want to look at your chart then, very quickly, I want to define my terms here that as I will be using them in my lectures. Don't necessarily assume that this is how the terms are going to be used in every discussion by everybody. We may need to ask people what they mean. But here's what I'm going to mean in my lectures by these terms. Modernism, postmodernism, and what I will call biblicism. I just mean a biblical worldview by that. There are, what do I have, seven categories, six, seven, eight, nine categories here that I think each, we can look at how each of these positions, modernism, biblicism, and postmodernism, how they look at these particular categories. The first one is human reason. What we're going to see in this chart is that for the most part, given these nine categories, I would argue for the majority of these issues, biblicism is more comfortable with modernism than it is with postmodernism in most of these categories. But there are a couple of categories where I would argue biblicism was more comfortable with what postmodernism is saying than what modernism is saying in a couple of these. You've probably done enough reading to know that we've read some articles by Christians, by roughly evangelical Christians, who are fairly comfortable with postmodernism or seem to be really enamored with the idea of the breakthrough that we can have in our faith if we embrace more and more the themes of postmodernism. I'm taking a different perspective on that. I don't think that's true. I think postmodernism, for the most part, will lead us astray. But I do think, as I have suggested, that there are a couple of places where postmodernism and biblicism will overlap. What about human reason? Perspective of modernism is that human reason is a God-given, or as many of them would have it, a nature-given rather than God-given, but a God-given or nature-given tool for achieving an understanding of objective reality. It has certain foundational structures that determine the way it functions. Reed is a real classic proponent of that kind of view. Sometimes you will notice postmodernism is called post-structuralism. I think this is why. Unlike Reed, who believes that there are certain structures to the human intellect, certain structures to objective reality, and that we come to know both the intellect and reality by learning of its structures, postmodernism is rejecting that. No, there are no fixed, determinate structures of the human mind and human intelligence. It's fluid, it's dynamic, it's changing, it's evolving, it's malleable. They're decidedly taking issue with someone like Reed at that point. Reed, in this sense, as a modernist, believes that there are structures to the way the human mind works. Biblicism is fundamentally in agreement with modernism, I would say, at that point. Human reason is a God-given tool for achieving an understanding of objective reality, and I could have Reed there as well, because he's clearly coming from a biblical worldview when he writes. Postmodernism, on the other hand, what I mean by it, as I'm understanding it now, takes the position that reason is a social and cultural construct, not a God-given tool for grasping objective reality. And what I mean by a construct is it's like our culture and other people impinge upon us, impact us, have an effect on us, play a role in our lives in shaping the way we think, the way we value things, the way we look at evidence, what we consider evidence and not evidence, what we would consider a good argument or not a good argument, what we would consider conclusive and not conclusive, our personal values, our personal prejudices. All those things are one way or another handed to us, absorbed, imbued in us by our interactions with other people in our culture. And they basically make our minds, they create our minds, they mold our minds to make it what it is, or our reason to be what it is. And they're arguing that that's just simply a universal fact of human existence. So there are no fixed and determinate structures that determine how we use our reason and what our reason is. It has no innate structure that is fixed and immutable. Okay, what about objective reality? What are we, a world external to us out there, is everything just in my mind, in my head, or is there something out there that I am seeing or knowing or perceiving? Modernism says objective reality is a real realm of being outside of us that just is what it is. It has certain innate structures that make it what it is. Those structures are ultimately discoverable, maybe difficult to discover, but in principle, they're discoverable. Objective reality, therefore, is something that ultimately can be known by man through the tools and methods of science. And I should emphasize of science, because one of the things that characterizes modernism is its being absolutely infatuated with the natural sciences and the scientific method and the methods that were being developed during the Enlightenment. Biblicism, mostly, not entirely, but mostly in agreement with modernism. Objective reality is a real realm of being outside of ourselves that just is what it is. Objective reality is something that ultimately can be known by man. However, unlike modernism, biblicism sees the totality of human reason and common sense, not the scientific method, to be the means to that knowledge. One of my lectures I'll devote a significant portion of it to what do we really mean, how do we define reason. It is much more than science, and it's important to recognize that. One of your articles basically assumes that the biblical worldview equates reason and science. I've maybe known two people in my entire life that made that mistake. I don't think Christians have done that, not even the worst of Christians have equated scientific method and your approach to the Bible and to the faith. Some probably have, but I think that's to mischaracterize what's happened in our culture to make that claim. So, not the scientific method, it's human reason and common sense is the means that to that knowledge about the external world. Biblicism gives no privileged place to modern science per se. And that is important, and that is a point where biblicism will overlap with postmodernism. That's true. Postmodernism, on the other hand, objective reality is not something that can be known. At best, we invent a story that we tell ourselves about objective reality in order to make an attempt to order it for ourselves and make sense of it for ourselves. We do not and cannot come to know the underlying structures of reality. Now, one question that a person could raise is, do they even believe that there is something out there that has its own existence and structures independent of us? I don't know. I'm inclined to give postmodernists the benefit of the doubt and assume that they would grant that much. I can't be sure about that. But I don't, when they talk about different realities and we create our own reality and that sort of thing, I don't think that they really mean, you know, all of human experience is simply a figment of our imagination. I mean, that would be crazy. So I don't think that's what they mean. I think what they mean is whatever reality is in and of itself, we can never know that. We can never experience that. We can never get at that. We always only experience my experience of reality, and that is something that we concoct. That is something that we invent, something that we shape ourselves. It's a story we tell ourselves. It's an ordering of our reality to suit our needs, our pleasures, our desires in one way or the other, helped along by our society and our culture, our friends. You never do it alone. You do it with your friends. But one way or the other, it's a story that we tell ourselves. It's not the way it is in and of itself. Okay, what about truth? This is confusing to someone simple like me who likes to communicate in ordinary language. When people are talking about truth, I always assume they're talking about truth. Oftentimes, postmodernists are not talking about truth when they talk about truth. What they really mean are truth claims. What we purport to be true, what we say is true, what claims we're making about reality. So oftentimes they'll just use a shorthand and call it truth when what they really mean is a truth claim. And then they'll deny the reality of truth. And then what we mean by that is they're denying that any of our truth claims are really getting it completely the way it is. And then they're saying, live with it. Don't worry about it. Don't sweat it. But let me back up. What about the modernism with respect to truth claims? Modernism says it's possible in principle to offer an explanation or description of aspects of objective reality that articulate them for what they actually are in objective reality. Truth is possible. A valid truth claim is a possibility for modernism. Biblicism is fundamentally, I would say, fundamentally in agreement with modernism. It's possible in principle to offer an explanation or description of objective reality that gets it right. So we can make bona fide truth claims. Postmodernism, on the other hand, is saying that no truth claim is in fact a valid explanation or description of objective reality for what it actually is. It's not at all possible. No bona fide truth claim is possible. That, I would argue, is what Nietzsche is saying. Okay, what about language? Modernism says that language, being an aspect of human reason, is a God-given or nature-given tool for using to understand and to communicate an understanding of objective reality. So in principle, it's possible through language for one person to convey his thoughts and ideas to another. Biblicism is fundamentally in agreement with that. Language is a God-given tool for, and here I would argue, biblicism is richer than modernism. I don't think it takes a stand on a philosophy of language that says language is only for communication. Language, we do more with language than merely communicate and convey one idea to another. Language is a very versatile tool, so it's many-faceted, and a biblical worldview doesn't have to deny that. But among other things, it is a tool that God has given us for achieving an understanding of objective reality and communicating that to others. So it is, in principle, possible through language for one person to convey his thoughts and ideas to another. So, but it's multifaceted. Its use and purpose is not confined to that as such. Postmodernism, on the other hand, says that language is a social cultural construct, just as reason was. It's a contrivance of social political processes. It is not ultimately capable of conveying one person's thoughts and ideas to another. It's not capable of doing so. It is ever in flux. It's never definitive. It's fundamentally vague, inexact, and incomprehensible. So what are we doing with language? We're just kind of playing with each other. I say something to you, and you construe it the way you construe it, and you say something back to me, and I construe it the way I construe it, and I say something back to you, and you construe it the way you construe it. Sounds like real life. There is some fundamental truth in what they're saying here, but is that the problem of language per se, or is that interpersonal relationships that makes that a dynamic that explains our life to us? They're saying the problem is language. I think a biblical viewpoint would say, to the extent that that happens, that's because of people, not language. It's because of other aspects of what makes people people. Selfishness, self-centeredness, sin, prejudice, pride, all that kind of stuff can come in and muddy the waters of communication. But it's not because language as such is incapable of making communication possible. It's because people have a hard time with it. But postmodernism is taking that very real phenomenon and saying that's inherent to the very nature of language itself. It's indeterminate, vague, inexact, and ultimately mysterious and incomprehensible, I think, if I'm understanding them. What about morality? For modernism, morality is an objective reality, and human reason is capable of grasping its truth. There are things that just are good and things that just are evil. And we can figure that out through human reason. Biblicism, I would say, is fundamentally in agreement with that. Morality is objective reality. Human reason is capable of grasping its truth. Postmodernism says that morality and other value systems are, you guessed it, a social and cultural construct invented by one group fundamentally to gain power and dominance and maintain their power and dominance over other groups. A political ploy, fundamentally. What about the self? For modernism, there exists an individual being created by God or by nature, depending upon the modernist, with a definitive being and a definitive nature who believes, reasons, thinks, feels, and chooses. Again, biblicism, I think, is fundamentally in agreement with that. There exists an individual being created by God with a definitive being and or nature who believes, reasons, thinks, feels, and chooses. I should have cut the nature in that one. That didn't belong there in the biblical view. Postmodernism, on the other hand, when it comes to the self, there is no individual being created by God or nature with a definitive being and or a nature who believes, reasons, thinks, feels, and chooses out of autonomous individuality, anyway. The self is the product of social, cultural, political forces and the language and ideas that convey those forces. And you actually have the seeds of this view in Hume himself, where the self dissolves into a bundle of perceptions. All you got, just a bundle of perceptions, and who did the bundling them? And one of the most ironic and troubling aspects of Hume is trying to figure out, when you realize you are not a self, who is the you who is realizing that you are not a self? I don't know if you can solve that one. What about philosophical systems? Modernism says that grand philosophical systems are attempts at a coherent grasp of the truth about the whole of reality. Now, most postmodernists come out of Marxism, it seems to me. So they have in mind Hegel and Marx, and maybe we can talk about Hegel and Marx a little bit as the time is right. But both Hegel and Marx have these grand sweeping stories to tell about what history is doing, where it's going, what it's all about, what's behind it. They're telling this grand story about reality. Postmodernism is going to reject all that. Biblicism, however, again, is mostly in agreement with modernism on that point. Grand philosophical systems are, in fact, attempts at a coherent grasp of the truth about the whole of reality. However, it acknowledges with postmodernism that many such attempts are, in fact, mostly fiction. The Bible would look at Hegel and say, you're making all that up. That's just a story. Would look at Marx and say, you're making all that up. That's just a story. That's a fiction that you're telling yourself about reality. And most of the stories that philosophers have told about reality are fictions, are stories. But just because most of them are fictions doesn't mean there can't be a nonfiction. And that's the biblical perspective. The agenda of such fictions, however, are not restricted. And then another difference is, from a biblical point of view, the agenda of those fictions are not restricted to social and political agendas. For the postmodernist, almost always your agenda is a social political agenda. The Bible recognizes that often it can be just a plain old personal agenda. If you've ever read Paul Johnson's book, Intellectuals, it's very, very, very keen insights into the role that the personal lives of those philosophers played in shaping the ultimate shape of their philosophy. They had a story they wanted to tell to justify their life. Quite apart from any political and social realities or agendas, they just wanted to justify their own stinking life. And they came up with a story to tell themselves that would do that. Postmodernism says that grand philosophical systems are complete fictions, always necessarily by their very nature, and that stories, they're stories that we are making up. Their utility is to preserve social and political power by giving an account that encourages acquiescence and submission. Okay? At least that's what I'm going to mean by postmodernism when I use the term. Okay, what about science? To the modernist, science will lead the way to truth and a glorious utopia. You especially see that in Marxism and in what's called positivism during the tail end of the Enlightenment. Science is going to lead the way. Science is going to solve all of our problems. Science is going to make the whole world better. At this point, biblicism is much closer to postmodernism than it is to modernism. Science will likely lead, in fact, to oppression, slavery, racism, poverty, war, and all kinds of mean, nasty things, rather than to the utopia. But unlike postmodernism, its deleterious effects are due primarily to human sinfulness, not to the nature of the claims of science per se. See, what postmodernism tends to emphasize is, it's the absolutist nature of the claims that is the problem. It's because you're so cocksure about what you're saying that leads to all these mean, nasty things. I think from a biblical perspective, it's not the nature of the claims. The claims are either false or true, either right or wrong. What we do with those claims and how we use those and utilize those claims has more to do with us as people, as sinful human beings, than it does with the nature of science or the nature of philosophy or the nature of the sorts of claims that we're making. There is nothing intrinsically wrong with knowledge claims. It is what a human being does with such claims that makes all the difference. The fact that you could have a basically decent human being who makes an absolute claim and it's false, they've got it wrong, who is not necessarily going to exploit what that claim makes to be unkind and cruel to other people. It's all about the people and what they do with it rather than the claims being made. Postmodernism, on the other hand, says that science will lead to oppression, slavery, racism, poverty, war, and all kinds of mean, nasty things, period. That's just the way it goes. And then finally, and this is more controversial, this is the perspective I'm going to take, whether it's right or not and fair or not, that's for you to decide. How should we then live in view of each of these things? In modernism, we should seek to be rational and live in accord with reason. Biblicism is different than that. That's not really fundamentally what biblicism would say. Rather, it would say that we should seek to be godly and to live in accord with the character, purposes, and promises of God. That includes rationality, but it's not exhausted by rationality. There's much more to what it means to be godly than being rational. Whereas modernism is very narrow in that regard. What about postmodernism? We'll talk more about this later, whether it is even making any sort of claim like this at all. When it does, and to the degree that it does, I would argue that postmodernism would recommend that we seek to be courageously abnormal and perverse, that we need to live against the structures that are in place, go against the values that are in place, violate and transgress the boundaries that are in place in our society, to keep human beings honest. We need to be continually upsetting the apple cart. because we don't want anything to get fixed, nothing to become concrete. Because when it gets institutionalized, when it becomes objectified, when it becomes absolutized, evil results from that. So the only way we can prevent evil in the world is to keep things moving, keep them in flux, keep them questioning themselves so that they can never get solidified and in place. So we need to have the courage to be abnormal and downright perverse by the standards of our culture in order to really do what needs to be done in this world to keep it a better place. Well, you couldn't get more more against the biblical view on that one. Okay, so that's what we expect. What I expect to do is to try to make a case for basically those conclusions that I have outlined here today. Where I'm going to start, and I'll end with this, where I'm going to start is to raise the question, is there a biblical philosophy of reason at all? I'm going to argue that I'm going to give a yes and no answer to that, and that yes or no answer explains that why in the Bible lectures I'm not going to lecture on the Bible, because there's the interest and the concerns that we have are not something that the Bible directly takes on, and I'm going to argue why it doesn't. Do so, why it doesn't do so, and why it doesn't have to do so in my first lecture, and then we'll go from there.